Welcome back to Geopolitics, ladies and gentlemen. My name is James Evan Pilato, your host and webmaster from MediaMonarchy.com. And for the third installment of this new Geopolitics series, I knew from the very beginning on my short list of folks I wanted to talk to was someone we've talked to almost 2 years ago, and then the Malaysian Flight 370 happened. I already wanted to have you on, Niall Bowie, but then that brought a bit of extra gravity and urgency to the proceedings. So thanks so much for coming on Geopolitics.
I know, it's a shame we haven't spoken like in earnest in about 2 years. That's a real shame. Well, we ought to do something about that. And it's an unusual or sad circumstance that it would have to be this aircraft disaster that would get me on. But, you know, let's cover it anyway.
And as you and I were just kind of talking off mic a little bit, as far as this missing Flight 370 goes, and in a way, it's, you know, I just want to, it's all a developing story. So who knows from how long after this point we'll still be asking questions.
Mm.
But I don't want to go through all the minutiae of it here. I essentially wanted to just ask you, for starters, as an American living in, you're still in Kuala Lumpur, right?
Yeah, I've been here for 3 years.
For 3 years. I want to know what it's like being in a place where suddenly the world's eyes are all looking and going and asking, you know, what's going on?
Sure. Well, that's a great question. Now, this aircraft disaster has come at a very unsavory time for the ruling government. You know, Malaysia has been, since its independence for almost six decades, it's been run by the same government. There's been it's parliamentary democracy, but there's never been a change of government. So the government is very much entrenched, and its popularity is decreasing quite rapidly. As every election goes by, they're getting less and less at the polls. And over the past couple months, they have rolled back some long-standing subsidies that have made, you know, economic conditions very difficult in Malaysia. And quite frankly, the opposition here, they dominate social media, and most young people, and we can say that most minorities in Malaysia, Malaysia is predominantly a Malay Muslim country. It's about 60% of the population, and other minority groups such as the Chinese and the Indians, who have a huge economic clout in the country, and also they're very much politically representative. They have a lot of negative things to say about the government. I think some of it is justified, some of it isn't. But what this aircraft disaster has done is, at least for the opposition, they have used this situation to politicize the way the government has fumbled over this issue. Now, certainly the government has fumbled on a couple of major things, but what I'd like to highlight is that this is such an unprecedented scenario. This is the longest missing, you know, civilian aircraft in modern aviation history. This is also the largest multinational search sort of investigation, you know, happening at the largest one that there's ever been. So over 26 countries are taking part in this. So I don't think, from the offset, I'll say I don't think it's fair that Malaysia should shoulder all of the blame for this. Mm-hmm. But I do believe that there are a couple key areas where, you know, they majorly screwed up. One of them is that, you know, after less than an hour, you know, the plane had taken off from Kuala Lumpur, and it was between the Vietnamese and Malaysian airspace in the South China Sea. At that point, that's when the transponders were turned off and the plane was turned around, U-turned, and was flying back towards the northern straits of Malacca and the Andaman Sea, so back over the Malaysian Peninsula. Now, from what I understand, at that point, the plane was flying low, and it basically passed through at least three military radar zones. And that apparently the military had monitored that, but it was not red flagged or deemed as suspicious because the plane's profile showed it to be a civilian airliner. So this is the biggest screw up in my opinion, because had the response been different, you know, we could have had aircraft and jets come to perhaps see what's going on with this aircraft, intercept the aircraft, and to perhaps guide it to a safe landing or something like that. But there was no response. And I think part of the reason that Malaysia has been somewhat reluctant to speak about or late to provide crucial information was because they were a little bit embarrassed or disinclined to admit that you know, this craft had penetrated the airspace and nothing was done about it. You know, so that's a major security hole. And as we remember, it took about a week before the government in Malaysia actually admitted that the craft had, you know, ended up either on the northern or southern arc. You know, for the first couple of days of the search, it was focused primarily in the South China Sea. So if the plane did indeed crash, you know, in the Indian Ocean, in the southern Indian Ocean, which is probably a very remote part and very difficult to access, it's probably likely that no one did survive, you know, even from the onset. But the Chinese argument is that, you know, the most valuable window of time to do search and rescue was squandered by, you know, the fact that poor intel led the search and rescue team to look primarily in the South China Sea, as we know, quite far away from where it presumably ended up. And the article that I had published yesterday with Russia Today primarily spoke a little bit about the diplomatic row that has ensued between Malaysia and China over this relatively, you know, harmonious relationship that these two countries have had for the past several decades. But now, because of this disaster, we see figures in the Malaysian foreign ministry almost daily throughout this whole scenario and ordeal cajoling, you know, members of Malaysian authorities to, you know, release more accurate information in a timely manner. And to be fair, I think the Chinese government were under a lot of pressure from Chinese society, who, you know, were very much in solidarity with the families. And we can only imagine the grief, you know, of all those families. You know, it's just a terrible drawn out ordeal not to be able to get the right answers, not to be able to know. You know, I can imagine some of these people have had, you know, they've lost two or three generations of family members on this flight. So all around, just a tragedy. But I think in terms of the diplomatic situation today, you might have seen the news that there were families and people who were supporting the families. They almost stormed the Malaysian embassy mm-hmm. in Beijing, you know, but the police were able to hold them back. But certainly this whole ordeal has dented Malaysia's image abroad, you know, pretty severely. And the last thing I want to add, maybe if you have any more questions, is that this morning, prior to or following this announcement by the Malaysian Prime Minister Najib Razak yesterday that the plane was presumably did crash with no survivors in the southern Indian Ocean, an anonymous source who is very much close to the investigation believes with high confidence that the plane was taken down intentionally. And this person is endorsing the pilot suicide motive, which I think is very, very probably accurate at this point. From what we can tell, the flight had navigated in a very calculated and deliberate way in terms of flying in a way that a certain technique called terrain masking, which in a sense, you know, this plane was hugging, you know, some mountainous regions and the ground and the water at some time to avoid radar. And that's as far as I understand, that's a military technique, a way to fly your craft in a stealth way. So the person who was flying the plane was obviously very competent. And what I posited in my article was two possible scenarios. We still have no idea about the motives, if the pilot was engaged in some kind of a suicide mission. You know, we don't know why. However, it's interesting to point out that according to reports, a couple hours before Zahiri Aman Shah, who's the main pilot, got on the plane, he attended the court hearing of Malaysian opposition leader Anwar Ibrahim, who was again tried for sodomy, and he was convicted 5 years jail. And the reports say that this pilot was a obsessive supporter of the Malaysian opposition. There are accounts where he's wearing T-shirts supporting with opposition slogans on them. And I believe he's also a distant family member of Anwar Ibrahim, the opposition leader. So one possibility, although there's no evidence to substantiate this, is that, you know, he was so upset. He felt that this was a grave injustice that this opposition leader, who is seen by some in Malaysia to be, you know, the last great hope of political reform, you know, that his jailing represented, you know, a grave injustice. So there's some theory that perhaps this guy, you know, he flew the plane intentionally into a very remote part of the ocean as some kind of a political protest, perhaps to damage the government's credibility or to set off a diplomatic row with China, you know, but basically to cause damage to the ruling party and a political nightmare, which if that's what he wanted to do, then that's exactly what's happened. You know, and the other situation I posited, which now seems less likely, and it was only really ever speculation, was the fact that, as James Corbett mentioned in the New World Next Week, I think a week or two ago, that the Boeing 777s, they do have a security vulnerability that would allow them to potentially be, we can say, hacked into, and using, you know, radio frequencies, it could perhaps manipulate the speed, the direction of the aircraft. But again, we have no evidence for that either. And, you know, investigators are basically saying that this looks like a pilot suicide. So I'm leaning towards that. What do you think?
It seems like the perfect stew of all of those elements, that it will somehow come into play, that it will be involving those military bases and also involving vulnerability technologically with the plane itself, and possibly a pilot who was in some ways a patsy of sorts.
It would certainly be tragic if that's the case. I mean, I'm reluctant to stamp names on anyone, because this was someone who was flying for, you know, over two decades, 18,000 hours in the air, and basically a very clean record. So it would be very surprising if this happened, but certainly the possibility should be considered. And I think it's also very odd, very strange, that considering the U.S. military presence in the region, Changi Air Base in Singapore, and, you know, all of the littoral ships, you know, in the region, mm-hmm. and the listening stations, mm-hmm. you know, I'm surprised that nothing was done to intercept this aircraft, and apparently it was undetected. I mean, that just seems a little strange.
Well, and I think that's to me is what is turned it into the sort of the perfect classic conspiracy stew, because there's the questions mm-hmm. of the phone calls. Where could you get the phone calls through? And is there a plane? And was it hijacked? Was there a drill going on? Not that I've heard anything about drills going on, but it seems to have all those perfect elements that I think, to bring it back full scale, something like this is sort of, it's completely unprecedented in a way that has the worldwide audience.
Well, sure, because there's mystery involved, and there's a possible intrigue, possible uh-huh. political conspiracy. And I mean, I can only imagine, you know, what it must have been like to be relatives of these passengers, who were able, for the first couple days, it seemed like they were able to, you know, contact mobile phones of the people on board. And, you know, in my mind, I thought that meant that, you know, the plane must have landed somewhere, and it must have been somewhere where, you know, these phones, maybe they haven't been turned off prior to the plane taking off. Maybe they were receiving a signal, but, you know, no one was there to pick them up. And, you know, the families had also reported that some of the people on board were seen as online on their QQ, which is like a Chinese version of Skype. Uh-huh, they were seen as online for the first couple days, you know. So this created so many, I guess, such a false sense of hope that, you know, must have been extremely excruciating for these families, you know, to have gone through all of these things. But, I mean, what I'll say is that the black box, we have to wait for the black box and see what comes out of the official investigation. But in terms of being an independent journalist, we should also prod every possibility and scrutinize it until it's either proven to be plausible or false. Mm-hmm.
I guess the last thing I would ask you concerning this, I guess I'm wondering or trying to get a sense of, does it feel different out on the street?
You know, that was really the first question you asked, but I didn't answer it. But what it feels like in terms of, all right, so, you know, this is what most of the taxi drivers, the people at the local, you know, mom and pop restaurants are talking about. This has been a topic of heavy discussion over social media. I get the sense that now we're on the third week after this happened, that a lot of people have been, I guess, quite depressed or confused by all the parallel theories, that they've kind of stopped following it. I feel that a lot of people have done that. But certainly this is something that, I guess, an incident that has brought Malaysians together, being such a multi-ethnic and multi-religious country. It is one thing. I guess sociologically, when there's a massive crisis, it tends to bring people together and it diminishes, you know, communal gaps and tensions to some extent. So I do believe that there were some interreligious services that were held in the days following, you know, the initial, you know, loss of the aircraft, and regularly since then. So I think this is, in some way, Malaysians have had solidarity, you know, with each other over this disaster. But it seems like, you know, the 2/3 of the passengers on board were from China, and it seems like Malaysia is going to have some, at least the very minimal, economic consequences because of this. Because normally, you know, some 2 million Chinese tourists or somewhere near that number visited Malaysia last year, and there are daily flights back and forth. And Malaysia is the number one trading partner of China in the ASEAN region in Southeast Asia. So perhaps there could be less people traffic, and also there is a mistrust, I think, diplomatically after this situation. We've seen in Chinese media, like in the People's Daily and the Global Times, which is known to reflect the leadership of a government in China, that they've not only criticized Malaysia's handling of this disaster, but I've seen recently, I've linked to this in my article, you know, the Global Times actually really doing an in-depth criticism of Malaysia's political and economic system, and pretty scathing criticism. So that hasn't really happened before, and it's no doubt linked to, you know, some bad blood and an image over this situation.
Well, and now I think that we're kind of bringing in China into the picture. If you want to kind of go over, because I think that's another area that we did want to kind of look at how, if to sort of spring off from Malaysia into their relations with China, and I think the wider sort of Asia Pacific, if you will.
Okay. Well, what we've seen, I guess, take the most headlines was, I believe, in November when China declared an air defense zone over one of its regions in the southeast, which would cover what the Chinese call the Diaoyu Islands and what the Japanese call the Senkaku Islands. So these are a contested region of islands that both countries lay claim to. And when the Chinese, you know, laid out this air defense zone, it was, if we remember, it was condemned by you know, Tokyo, and certainly condemned by Washington. And if we can also remember that immediately after it happened, so as just to challenge it, the United States military flew a B-2 bomber over the airspace deliberately and had it turned back. And it was said that this was something that was planned in advance, but I don't believe that's true. And shortly after, the Japanese and South Koreans, surprisingly enough, it's not that surprising, but it's a bit bold for them to do that, but they also flew through this air defense zone, and they've challenged that. So what this air defense zone, it basically means that, you know, if an aircraft would want to pass through there, they would need to ring up, I guess, Chinese air traffic control or whatever authority would be responsible for maintaining, you know, control over that airspace, and basically just getting a green light to fly through that airspace. So this comes at a very interesting time when we see the Prime Minister in Japan, Shinzo Abe, who came into power December 2012, who, I mean, I guess a lot of people would argue that he's been among one of the most influential Japanese prime ministers in recent years. I think Japanese politics has been characterized by something like a revolving door scenario. So Shinzo Abe came to power, and, you know, he's overseeing a country that is going through more than 2 decades of stagnation, economic stagnation, and certainly a situation where partners are not so much partners, but regional allies like South Korea are overtaking them in terms of their economic output and producing electronics and things like that. Things that Japan used to really do very well in a lot of different areas. So Shinzo Abe has come to power. He's introduced the Abenomics, which is essentially a whole series of neoliberal reforms designed to bring in foreign investment and shore up big business. And he's doing a whole range of things, making a whole range of economic reforms and reforms to create some inflation in the Japanese currency to get the economy going. And from what we can tell so far, it has more or less been below expectations, although we can see the likes of Bloomberg and the mainstream financial press, you know, praising it, you know, when it was first being rolled out. But it hasn't amounted to much from what I can say. But primarily where Shinzo Abe's support has come from is from his ability to really successfully play the nationalist card. And by doing that, I think the most controversial aspect of this nationalist program he's done was at the end of last year, he visited the Yasukuni Shrine. So the Yasukuni Shrine is a place which honors the memories or honors the World War II dead, which also includes something like 70 Class A war criminals belong to the Imperial Japanese Forces. So this is an extremely sensitive issue in Japan. And if I'm correct, the current emperor of Japan has even refused to visit the site since these war criminals were inducted in the 70s because the site has become too politicized, according to him. So the fact that Abe went there, it created a lot of bad blood with China and Japan because these were countries that were occupied and under the boot of Japanese imperialism around World War II. And we can also understand the anger of South Korean people. You know, the comfort women issue was extremely sensitive. So what Abe has done is, in a sense, he's passed some very very controversial state secret laws, which would punish whistleblowers and the like. Some have likened these laws to that of similar kind of laws in Imperial Japan, although I think that might be kind of a stretch. But we can see like how badly the Fukushima situation was covered by journalists, and we can only, you know, make comparisons like what this law would do to journalists who are reporting something different. Perhaps it would really roll back some of the press freedoms in that country. As well, he has made it quite clear that he intends to amend the Japanese Constitution, Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution. It basically forbids the use of force in handling any military conflict by a standing Japanese army. So there are initiatives for Japan to essentially bolster its military presence and to build up its army. And this is something that Japanese people, I think, who are struggling, you know, at this point, they take some, you know, they see Abe going in a nationalist direction and it works for them. That has made him very successful at the polls. Now, basically, what we've seen is over the past couple months, it's been relatively quiet now, but what we've seen over the past couple months is this row over these islands, you know, the Senkaku and Diaoyu Islands. And we're sort of in a situation now where if Abe were to back down, he would get a huge domestic backlash because this is seen as a non-negotiable issue of territorial integrity. When personally, I wrote this article a couple months ago assessing, you know, the legitimacy of you know, which country does do these islands belong to? And what I said was, you know, there are clear records that this territory has long been a part of China, you know, for hundreds of years. And if we look at foreign maps, you know, from the 1700s and 1800s, they include this area of China as part of China, you know, these Diaoyu Islands as part of China. So I believe that the Chinese have very legitimate, you know, territorial claims. And I think it's a big problem in terms of hypocrisy, in a sense that the Chinese are not allowed to make this air defense zone space, you know, in this part of their territory, when, you know, the Japanese have done similar things, you know, and the United States doesn't really feel feel the need to challenge Japan when it does those things. So in a geopolitical sense, what I believe is that the United States is somewhat turned off by the Abe administration's ideological stance, like regarding his visit to Yanakuza Shrine and also you know, the fact that he's promoted some people to NHK, which is Japan's public broadcaster, some people who have expressed very historically inaccurate views, and I would say very offensive views. Someone who was promoted denied the whole that Japan had taken these hundreds of thousands of comfort women, you know. I believe that the U.S. is probably a little upset that the Japanese are so blatantly whitewashing their own history. But at the same time, I don't think that's really a factor that's going to change anything that Washington's doing in that part of the world. It is basically giving a green light to Japan to sort of pursue the agenda that it's been pursuing now. And that is, from what I can tell, moving towards a situation where Article 9 is amended, and perhaps Japan can be brought into some kind of a anti-China security regime, you know, like an Asian NATO, which some people have spoken about. And we should remember when Abe spoke at the latest Davos Forum, Switzerland, a couple weeks ago, he had compared the situation between China and Japan today with 1914. Although I don't think that's a very accurate, you know, kind of comparison, but what he argued was that, you know, just because two powers have great economic incentives to trade with each other doesn't mean that that war can be fully prevented.
You mentioned Fukushima, which only in my mind brings up one perhaps odd thing I'll throw at you before we'll keep moving.
Sure.
I couldn't help be sure, and I wonder if it may end up being viewed this way or not. The reaction to, not the reaction, but the, I suppose, the Japanese government's cover up and sort of the fumbling of Fukushima. Well, that in any way, I couldn't help be struck by that one we were watching in the early days of this missing flight, where the sort of blame almost seemed to be, if you were more open, if people were more open, we wouldn't be asking and wondering all these kinds of questions. If you would have just been more forthright in the beginning, we could have seen the problem and tried to solve it a lot more earlier. And now it's all out of control and crazy.
Mm.
Is that, well, is that my own invention?
No, I see that as essentially what has happened in Fukushima. You know, from the onset, I think Japanese government and TEPCO seriously attempted to downplay, and they still are continuing to downplay and obfuscate a lot of the information. We know that, you know, in recent, I haven't been following this as close as I should, and I really should be following it more, but we know that tons of radioactive material has poured into, I mean, literally tons of this material has been leaked into the ocean since this situation happened. And you know, I sort of feel like, I mean, this is probably a bit irresponsible as a journalist, but I feel like I've seen the headlines for so many years now, just incredibly, you know, shocking, you know, inefficiency by TEPCO to really do anything about this problem. And I just almost feel like, you know, it's become the routine, it's become the new normal. And I don't think that perhaps Japanese people feel the same way as well, but I know there is a growing and a very strong anti-nuclear movement in Japan. And I feel that there are legitimate sort of grievances and reasons to feel like why, you know, these new kind of censorship laws, state laws that to discriminate against whistleblowers and these types of things would certainly allow for this kind of, you know, government cover-up thing to be more easily covered up. I don't really know how else to put it, but... but it's certainly a tragic situation, and I'm still sort of not exactly sure what the extent will be, what the in terms of human development indicators, what the real damage will be over generations that you know this Fukushima disaster has caused. But you know, I'm not sure if I really trust any Japanese sources on that.
and I think like a lot of the things that we're talking about, unfortunately, you reach a saturation point where even the best of us go, oh God, all right, I can't listen to that anymore.
Really, just to bring this up, it's a little off topic, but you know, I've felt like, you know, the past year watching the headlines come out of Iraq, you know, like every other day, basically, you know, a massive suicide bombing and 50 to 100 people killed, and you know, something like 9,000 people were killed, you know, in terrorist bombings all over Iraq, you know, last year, and it's also continuing the same pace this year from what I can tell. And it's just it's a terrible situation when things are so bad that even as journalists we feel like a bit like we're seeing the same headline over and over again and sort of don't know what to make of it, really, you know.
Well, and I think that's the peril of kind of the oversaturation of
we don't know what to make of it in a moral and ethical way. That's what I mean.
it becomes bizarre when all of these stories turn into just a sort of it's another show. Oh man, I'm sick of that show. I'm sick of the plane show. What else is on?
Yeah, from what I can tell, CNN has really kind of gone overboard with different theories about the Malaysian aircraft disaster. And from what I can tell, I mean, thankfully, I haven't watched CNN in a couple of years. You know, we don't really have it so often here in Malaysia. But from what I can tell, a lot of very significant issues were sort of put to the wayside because of this aircraft issue, sort of over and over again, 24-hour uh-huh. coverage. So. Uh-huh. It's poor journalism, in my opinion. You know, well, and even so, CNN is not going to have a very balanced commentators most of the time. Perhaps this could be a springboard that we can talk about Crimea.
Well, and that's actually what I was going to say, because I think the third area to get into. I think the segue, because it seems like it's turf wars again. So if we're talking about China and Japan with islands, then we can turn to what's going on right now. With Russia and Ukraine and Crimea, and the G8 is now the G7 is the latest news.
Surprise, surprise. Well, as I mentioned to you off mic, my view of the situation in Ukraine is not going to be very different from the Russian stance. And I guess what I would say is it goes like this. You know, we know that Russia, prior to the ouster of Yanukovych, they attempted to create a situation where a tripartite dialogue could take place between Ukraine, the European Union, and Russia. In a sense that, you know, Ukraine is this country that is near bankruptcy. Its economic situation is not doing well at all. And the best thing would be to have Ukraine utilize its unique geographic position as a bridge between these two regions, Europe and Russia, and have both blocs, you know, both nations support economically support Ukraine and to keep the situation together. And I believe there were a lot of important concessions made to the opposition. I mean, incredible concessions. I mean, Yanukovych offered a deputy prime minister role, you know, to members of the opposition. I believe it was the prime minister role, not just the deputy prime minister role. I believe it was the role of the PM. We see a whole range of concessions. And what we know happened, we don't have to go into great detail, but we know that a force was used by, you know, kind of hooligan types with Molotov cocktails and baseball bats and metal clubs to storm government buildings and to threaten the life of the democratically elected president Yanukovych, who, I mean, I don't have to say was known to be an extremely corrupt and inefficient politician. However, he was democratically elected. So his life was threatened. You know, his car was shot at. He originally had gone into eastern Ukraine, and he was in Crimea as well before going into Russia for his own safety. You know, and I feel that no country in the European Union would have given legitimacy to a government, a push regime, that had taken power in that way if it would have happened in a Western European or EU country. That's just not going to happen, you know. So they basically rubber-stamped, what I mean is the Washington and Brussels, they rubber-stamped this new regime in Kiev, which has a very dubious legitimacy, came to power by force. And, of course, this upset a great majority of the people in the country, ethnic Ukrainians, Russian speakers, you know, who felt like this new regime in Kiev did not represent them at all. And certainly the people in Crimea who were majority Russian, and they felt like this situation was, they weren't able to tolerate it. So what I think happened next, I think political positions and political biases have informed legal interpretations. Now, I think there are some areas where we can criticize Russia's, you know, a movement into Crimea. Mm-hmm. I can say that it was probably a mistake for Russia not to have engaged in dialogue. You know, we see now that Lavrov has spoken to the present Ukrainian foreign minister, I think just yesterday, but this is the first time they've spoke since the ouster of Yanukovych. So there were opportunities where Russia could have used and could have engaged in dialogue to decrease tensions. However, I believe, legally speaking, there is an agreement, an existing agreement, that would allow not more than 25,000 Russian troops to be based in Sevastopol in the Russian Black Sea, base there, which houses the Black Sea Fleet. And from what I understand, that Russia abided by that. They didn't bring in more troops than necessary. What is a little bit of a gray area is if these Russian troops did indeed go and police certain areas around Crimea, which it looked like they did, and sort of keep guard outside of Ukrainian military facilities, which it looks like they did. That's a little bit of a gray area. However, I would say that if the democratically elected and legally legitimate president of Yanukovych greenlighted Russia to have a military presence in Russia, which he did, and also the authorities in Crimea to greenlight that Russian presence in that territory, which they did do, perhaps it is, legally plausible, but it's certainly a gray area. But I think we've seen the media accuse Russia of, annexation and invasion and all of these things, and I think that's just an open distortion of what has taken place in Crimea. And the fact that this vote, this referendum in Crimea, which we can say more than 80%, I believe 87% or some high figure like that, came out to vote, and of those voters, over 96% of people voted to join the Russian Federation. So there's a clear democratic consensus here around this decision. We can also point to the international observers who were from European EU countries who debunked claims that this referendum was being held under the shadow of the Russian military and all of this, and there was pressure. A friend of mine, a journalist, Emmanuel Oxenreiter, who was reporting for RT at the time when he was in Crimea, basically debunked this entire narrative, and what he saw on the ground very much reflected the pictures that came out of Crimea, which is basically jubilance, celebration, and we really can't blame the people of Crimea for doing that, because that was historically part of Russia for a few centuries. It was only given to Ukraine, rubber stamped by Nikita Khrushchev, and no one was consulted about that. So after the fall of the Soviet Union, it was allowed to, remain part of Ukraine. But this referendum happened. It did happen quick, but it happened legitimately. And I feel that if Kosovo could unilaterally declare independence like that, and before even 2 years, it took 2 years for the UN to even acknowledge that that was legal. We see South Sudan having done the same thing. And we also see the precedent being set by Catalonia and Scotland. Mm-hmm. So I don't think we're rushing, or not we, but the Western world is rushing to point fingers and accuse these referendums of being against international law. But the Crimeans are not afforded that luxury purely for biased political reasons. And we see now that the head of NATO is now positing that the Russian military buildup in the towards the borders of Ukraine will allow the Russian military to invade up till the Moldovan border, and he's accusing Russia of perhaps plotting to join up with Transnistria, which is this very interesting breakaway region, a very small region in Moldova, which is on the coast of Ukraine. So basically positing that this would be a full annexation of Ukraine, where I see really no evidence of that. And it's clear warmongering. And it comes at an interesting time. 15 years is the day where NATO, rain bombs over a European city, Belgrade, ripped apart the Yugoslavia, completely against international law. So I think this situation really requires a great deal of looking at this with clarity, and looking at this from a very objective standpoint. And I feel like if we look at all of the things, geopolitical wrongs that have been done in the past few decades, I think the Russian so-called annexation of Crimea is really not high on the list at all.
I think we really touched on, in a great way, the three main areas that I kind of wanted to get into with you. So there with Russia and Ukraine and China and Japan, and of course, as we started with Malaysia and the world, I think as we kind of wrap up this episode of Geopolitics here, I just want to ask you, what do you think, what else are you watching? What do you see coming next? What are you excited about? What are you worried about?
One more statement on the situation in Ukraine.
Please.
I think to recognize this situation in Crimea as illegitimate, but to somehow recognize what happened in Kiev as legitimate is completely ridiculous in my view. And that is to the T, the policy of the EU and Washington right now. What I'm going to be covering next in my next article, what I'm going to be watching is President Obama's visit to Saudi Arabia in the last week of this month, which is apparently it's going to happen in the next few days. So we see that there is a serious rift that has emerged between Saudi Arabia and the United States over the policy taken in Syria, perhaps a policy taken in Egypt and elsewhere. This is basically Obama going there to reassure the Saudis. So there's a lot to cover. That's what I'm going to be looking at. I'm going to be writing a pretty extensive article about this later in the week or whenever Obama does attend.
So that's what you're watching. That's an article yet to come, and we'll of course link up all of your articles that you've mentioned and kind of gone over, as they're all on your main website, nilebowie.blogspot.com. Thank you for coming on here, especially as I think all the situations that we talked about are sort of also developing now, from Malaysia to Russia to China and beyond. So hopefully you and I will talk again very soon. And of course, anytime you have especially important and breaking news and analysis that you want to bring here, we'd be glad to have you.
Yes, sir. Well, keep me updated and I'll come on anytime you like. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Niall Bowie, thanks so much, man. Take care.